Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast, Connecting the Internet of Things. One size does not fit all. I'm Kurt Schwader, your moderator, with today's speakers Sanjay Mani from Echelon, David Barnett from RTI, Pete Jenny from Security Innovation, and Greg Fike from Silicon Labs. Today's schedule consists of about 50 minutes of presentation, leaving 10 minutes at the end of the hour for audience Q&A. Before we begin, I'd like to run down some important features of your viewing console. First is the Enlarge Slides button. This button will maximize the slides to fill your entire screen. The Download Slides button allows you to download and print the slides if you'd like a hard copy to follow along with. The button labeled Forward to a Friend enables you to send an email to someone that will include a registration link to this eCast so they can also attend. The Ask a Question text box enables you to participate in today's event. You simply type your question into the box and submit it using the Submit button. You can submit questions at any time during the presentations. We encourage you to do so early and often while you're looking at the material in question and it's fresh in your mind. We'll address as many of these as we can during the closing Q&A. And if you have a question pertaining to the eCast operation itself, you could submit those too, and we'll be happy to respond to you during the eCast. Welcome to the Internet of Very Different Things. You'll see that in the lower left, the Gartner projections for the Internet of Things worldwide, the blue lines indicate smartphones and tablets, while the green lines represent the Internet of Things. They're projecting these Internet of Things devices to reach 26 billion devices by 2020. IoT product and service suppliers will also be generating revenues exceeding $300 billion, and that will result in $1.9 trillion of global economic value through the sales and services of a variety of markets. And this isn't just coming from one market. It's coming from pretty much every industry that we have, from commerce to communications, agriculture, real estate, manufacturing, consumer devices, and industrial control. You name it, the Internet of Things is part of it. We're very happy to have a number of experts in IoT today. Our first speaker is Sanjay Mani. He's the Director of Product Management at Echelon Corporation. He has over 20 years of experience in product management, strategy, and marketing for the communication and computing products. Sanjay has far-reaching experience with networking and processing products for telecom and datacom. He started his career in silicon design at Bell Northern Research and holds a BSEE degree from IIT Bombay and MSWEEE from Carleton University in Ottawa. Sanjay, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Kurt, for that introduction. In this talk, I will be talking about the connectivity requirements for the industrial Internet of Things and explain why there has been and will continue to be a rich set of connectivity options to meet the varied needs of the industrial world around us. A simple way to define the industrial Internet of Things, also called the IIoT, is to ask the question, what kind of things does the IIoT connect? The IIoT connects a large variety of industrial sensors, transducers, and actuators. Sensors that sense, for example, light, radiation, pressure, temperature, frost, humidity, and the list goes on. And it also connects in industrial actuators that take some form of action, such as switches, motors, dimmers, relays, circuit breakers, pumps, valves, and here too, the list goes on. It forms communication networks between these endpoints over networks called field buses, whose purpose is to provide precise sensing and control to make optimal use of the high-value industrial and commercial assets that these sensors and actuators are attached to. As you can see, this world of industrial IoT is very different from the consumer IoT that connects personal and home-based devices. Since the 1970s, there have been a large variety of field bus protocols that are still in commission today. For example, just within the building automation and industrial process control space, there are about 35 such protocols. Each protocol has tens of millions of devices in operation today, and in all, there are over 1 billion networked industrial devices. These networks generate a lot of very useful data that is usually acted upon within these control networks, but this data is siloed within these networks. This data needs to be liberated and connected to the broader IT world, where IP networking rules and big data analysis can be performed to extract hidden value. Since the IIoT connects devices associated with high-value and long-lasting industrial and commercial assets, such as buildings, cities, factories, machines, utilities, and their distribution and delivery systems, it has its own very special and unique requirements that are quite different from the consumer IoT. It requires controls that work autonomously using distributed intelligence without the need for a human or any form of central intelligence. It requires reliable operation, often in noisy and harsh environments and over very long periods of time. Failures can be catastrophic, so industrial strength reliability is needed. In addition, the IIoT must deal with the fact that there is already a large install base of legacy devices, and backward compatibility along with modernization are both important considerations. And there will be no debate that secure and authorized control is extremely important in this environment. Unlike in the consumer and mobile markets, where wireless technology is well established and growing, the industrial IoT, we expect, will be a mix of wired and wireless links. Wired communication remains the most reliable and cost-effective in most industrial applications. Things such as dust, smoke, hot and cold temperatures, vibrations, and locations below ground or surrounded by thick concrete structures all diminish the reliability of wireless communications, making them unsuitable for many IIoT applications. Nevertheless, we will see the addition of wireless sensors and actuators, for example, in building controls or in streetlight controls as newer wireless options emerge. This means that the industrial IoT network will be a network that uses multiple link technologies. A good way to understand this will be by way of a few examples. Let's talk about two such examples, one in building automation and the other in street lighting. Here is depicted a modern building with a complete building automation system. There is a single logical network made up of a variety of links and link technologies, wired and wireless. Sensors produce values for multiple building systems, and human-machine interfaces are distributed around the system to provide convenient local access. There's a connection to an enterprise system to push alarms and alerts to the building managers, and the building should operate without manual intervention through a very long period of time. One example of the IIoT being different is in the area of wired connectivity itself, as in this building automation example we just saw. For reasons of reliability, wired options are preferred. Buildings are wired by installers that prefer very simple wiring methods with few restrictions in topology or electrical constraints. Ethernet is good for structured wiring, but requires a lot of complex networking gear that adds cost and requires special training, and it restricts the kinds of topologies it can be deployed in. RS-485 serial bus options provides a very simple bus topology, but it's quite hard and difficult to get it working correctly because of polarity sensitivities and terminations. What's needed is a very simple wiring scheme that runs on low-cost twisted pair copper wires, has no restrictions in topology, whether it's a bus or a loop or a star or a combination, and it's simple to terminate, is polarity insensitive, has high noise immunity, and requires no switches, and still can carry IP traffic. These are the properties of the free topology network that is popularly used in the building automation setting. A second example is connecting up outdoor streetlights in roadways, campuses, and parking lots. This has a very different set of challenges. Here you want to run no new wires. RF communication provides a good way to solve this problem, but RF signals can be disrupted by interference and obstructions. Power line communication is a good alternative where RF communication is difficult. What is needed here is a seamless hybrid network that can span both power line communication and RF communication to create a connected community of outdoor lights that conserves energy, provides safety, improves maintenance, and can add additional services such as pollution monitoring, traffic sensing, and so on. Based on just these two examples, it should be evident that there's not a one-size-fits-all connectivity for the IIoT. It is, however, important to have a common control networking framework with a consistent set of underlying services that supports a publish-subscribe model has distributed intelligence and where devices can form trusted groups and exchange messages reliably, and ideally, if the device can self-install. And very importantly, it's important to have devices from different manufacturers that are able to interoperate with each other. Echelon offers the LawnWorks and iZart control networking platforms and provides processors, transceivers, and management software to build an entire end-to-end solution. Echelon also offers vertically integrated control solutions for outdoor lighting and is the only provider that offers both PowerLine and RF solutions in a consistent communication mechanism. Echelon is a pioneer in peer-to-peer device networking. The company was founded in 1988, and for over two decades, Echelon has a big presence in building automation, smart grid, and outdoor lighting markets. We are already deployed in over 110 million IIoT devices worldwide and growing. Thank you, and back to you, Kurt.
Thank you very much. David Barnett is our next speaker. He's Vice President of Products and Markets at RTI. David has over 25 years of experience in distributed real-time and embedded systems. He began his career as a software engineering lead at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, where he was responsible for design and implementation of several distributed real-time applications. David has a BA in computer science from the University of California, Berkeley. David.
Thank you, Kurt, and thank you, everyone, for joining us today. What I'm going to be introducing is messaging middleware targeted also at the industrial Internet of Things, so providing a way for different applications that are embedded in industrial Internet applications to communicate with each other. So as Sanjay introduced for Echelon, RTI is also focused on the industrial Internet, which I want to contrast a little bit with the consumer Internet. So a lot of the Internet of Things applications, you know, that are commonly talked about in the press, for example, are consumer applications that involve connecting devices to IT applications running in a data center somewhere or in a cloud. And in the case of these consumer Internet of Things applications, for the most part, the intelligence lives in the cloud. Most of the intelligence is not in the device or in the edge of the device. So the odds are my cat cam doesn't talk to my washing machine, you know, or my light bulbs or my thermostat, for example. The industrial Internet of Things is very different. It consists of smart machines that have embedded intelligence in those machines, and those machines also communicate with each other. So examples would be planes, trains, automobiles, all the different medical devices in a hospital, the systems that control the power grid, for example. So these are all examples of industrial internet-type applications. If you peel back the onion on any of these applications, there are really two type of communication or distribution requirements within an industrial internet system. One is communication within a machine or device itself. So if you look at these devices, you know, most of them contain embedded control systems, for example, in your car. So they have sensors, you know, in the machine itself that are interfacing to the real world. You have applications that are doing streaming analytics and control based on that data that they're getting in and controlling actuators, as Sanjay introduced, as a result of that. There might be some local displays which might not be, you know, a rich graphical interface like a web browser. It could be like a dashboard in your car, for example. And then there's connectivity between different machines or back to IT or cloud systems for things like predictive maintenance, but also machine-to-machine communication in the field or at the edge. For example, if you're controlling the power grid and you need to balance power between, you know, a solar cell or solar array and a battery in a substation, for example, if you know, the sun or cloud moves over the solar array and all of a sudden you have less power, you've got to very quickly make a decision to rebalance power on the grid, you know, at the edge. You don't have time to send all that information back to a central operation system, you know, make a control decision there, and then send it back, you know, to the substation. You've got to make a quick decision, you know, in the field. So there's both internal communication requirements within these systems at the edge as well as the communication back to your central operation systems. So if you look then, the architecture of the industrial Internet of Things is really very different from the architecture of the consumer Internet of Things, because sort of in these boxes at the bottom I have both local communication and control within a machine or between machines deployed at the edge, as well as communication back to the data center cloud. But these things are all peers in the industrial internet architecture because I can have machines or devices directly communicating with each other or with applications deployed in the field. All the work or intelligence isn't in that centralized system. The centralized system is really just another peer in my system. So one of the challenges in implementing communications for the industrial internet is the unique requirements of these industrial internet applications that Sanjay also touched upon. So one is performance. These systems have to perform in real time because they're monitoring, controlling physical processes. So, you know, unlike a traditional IT or cloud system, you know, that can respond in a second to something, and maybe if it's, you know, Black Friday, Amazon might take a little bit longer to complete a transaction. You know, these systems always have to keep up with the incoming data and need to respond in, you know, milliseconds or in some cases even microseconds, you know, regardless of what the data volumes are. So even as your throughput goes up in the system, you still need to keep up with that incoming data. They also must have really uninterruptible reliability or nonstop availability. So again, 5 nines is often acceptable in an IT system where you can schedule downtime, but imagine if an airplane was only 5 nines reliable, nobody would ever fly, or if the broker or server running in your car somewhere had to fail over so you couldn't control your car for a few seconds while that failed over, you'd probably never drive. So these systems have to have, you know, completely nonstop availability. They also need to function autonomously, so you don't want to have a system administrator, you know, in your car, for example, or on a plane if, you know, somehow a device got disconnected from a network or reconnects, or even in a manufacturing environment when you plug a system in, you want it to work. In a hospital, if I move some equipment from one room to another, I just want to plug it in and have it work. So obviously we're talking about critical infrastructure applications, so security is essential, but one of the particular challenges with security in the industrial internet is I have to secure these systems without compromising on these other requirements. So I have to have security together with real-time performance and nonstop availability and autonomous, the ability to operate autonomously. So if one, again, takes a look at kind of consumer applications or traditional IT applications, the centralized approach they take is really not suitable for industrial internet-type applications. So the way application-to-application communication typically works in an IT system or consumer Internet of Things application is all data flows through a central point, a broker or server or enterprise service bus that's running in the data center or a cloud somewhere. So devices feed all their data into that broker, and that broker then distributes data as needed to different applications running in the data center or cloud that uses that. So there's a couple problems with this centralized architecture. One is that broker has to run on a server somewhere. It typically needs system administration, and that server has to be administered. And then from a performance perspective, it also operates as a bottleneck or choke point in your system because as throughput goes up, that broker can fall behind the data. So it's also adding an intermediary in your network. So instead of two applications or devices communicating directly with each other, you're going through an extra hop to talk to that broker and back to the device, which is particularly problematic when two devices that might be connected over a wide area network or mobile network are communicating with each other. It's very inefficient to first send that data to a data center or cloud and then send it to another device as opposed to just sending it device to device. And that broker also provides then a single point of failure in your system because if the broker fails, the whole system is either down or has to fail over, which can take, you know, seconds or minutes of downtime that isn't tolerable in an industrial internet type application. So RTI Connects DDS, which is our middleware product, is designed specifically for communication between applications embedded in intelligent machines and for machine-to-machine communication, peer-to-peer, not at the edge, not going through any sort of intermediary. So RTI Connects DDS has a completely decentralized architecture. It doesn't require any IT infrastructure in a data center or cloud, so you can communicate back to a data center or cloud, but that's not in the critical path of any of your communication. So it's designed specifically for these operational technology requirements found in intelligent machines and industrial internet applications, so it's very low latency and deterministic. It provides nonstop availability because there's no single point of failure, and applications automatically discover each other when they come up, so the systems are autonomous. They don't need any system administration. They just discover each other and spontaneously communicate when they're connected to the same network. From an application perspective, ConnexDDS uses a very simple publish-subscribe model. So the application that's interfacing to a sensor or embedded in a sensor just publishes the data it produces. A control application that needs that data just subscribes to sensor data and then would publish out commands to an actuator, for example, and that actuator would subscribe to commands and then maybe publish its status that might be used back at a control application. So for an application perspective, this is very easy to use, and another advantage is it also gives you significant flexibility as your system evolves over time. So, for example, if I add another sensor to my system, it just publishes data, and now my control application is automatically taking advantage of data from both sensors. I don't need to modify any other part of my system. Likewise, I might want to add a new application to my system, so, for example, a display application running in my control room that's giving my operators situational awareness regarding what's going on, so it's going to subscribe to sensor data, it's going to subscribe to status information, but I didn't have to change any other application in my system to run this display application. It's just taking advantage of the data that's already being published on my network. So these different applications that are very loosely coupled with each other, and they don't require any direct knowledge of each other. So it's similar to using a database. If I'm using a database, I don't care where that data in the database came from. I don't care what application put it in the database. The users of the data and the producers and consumers of the data are completely decoupled. So ConnexDDS works in the same way, but of course it's a messaging system, so there is no central database anywhere. It's all data in motion that's being exchanged between applications. So likewise, the security model used by ConnexDDS is also optimized for these real-time applications. So security is also implemented in a completely peer-to-peer manner. So all authentication and access control, encryption, and logging of security events is done at each peer on the network. So rather than sending all data to some broker that's making the security decisions, each application is determining which other applications are allowed to see and publish and subscribe to the data that that application is using. So it allows you to overlay security on an industrial internet network without compromising the low latency, high performance, or reliability of that system. So RTI's ConnexDDS product family consists of a couple of products. Our ConnexDDS professional product consists of a comprehensive environment both for building new applications, so we support a standard known as the data distribution service, so we provide applications with standard data distribution service or DDS APIs, and on the wire we use the standard DDS wire interoperability protocol. It includes capabilities to integrate with existing applications without having to change them if you want to connect them to new applications that use RTI Connect and the DDS standard, so it can both adapt legacy protocols that those applications use, so you can run interoperate with unmodified applications. It also includes a very rich set of tools to help you debug and test, optimize, and monitor distributed applications. We also have a small footprint version, ConnexDDS Micro, that's very highly portable to systems even that have bare metal and no operating system with a very small footprint, and a certifiable version, ConnexDDS Cert, that's designed to be certified to very stringent safety standards like DO-178C that's required for flight-critical systems. So obviously you want to make sure that any software that flies in an airplane has gone through the most rigorous possible safety certification. So ConnexDDS, because these are heterogeneous systems, it provides very interoperability across programming languages, different processor types, different operating systems, and different network types. RTI itself, we are the leading provider of messaging middleware for embedded applications. We're very active in standards, and we have over 1,000 customers using this technology today. And if you want to learn more, feel free to contact RTI. We have a complete evaluation on our website, so you can download the full ConnexDDS professional product. We also have some interactive demos if you want to learn how ConnectCDS works without doing any programming, and a wide variety of other resources like videos and white papers and examples. So thank you all very much for joining us today, and I'll turn it back over to you, Kurt.
Thanks, Dave. Our third speaker is Pete Jenny. He's the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at Security Innovation and a 30-year veteran of software development, testing, and security. He is also the inventor of CD Record, the first commercial SCSI recordable system. And he has a new venture named Resilient Machines, where as a co-founder and CTO, he creates and deploys novel cyber defense software specifically focused at embedded systems. Pete?
Thank you very much, Kurt. And thank you and welcome, everybody. I'm going to be speaking today about application security, which in contrast to network security has to do with the applications that run on the operating system. We're also going to be looking at those applications in the consumer IoT space, which makes up roughly 30% of the embedded market these days. And it's also the area that's the most vulnerable to attack. We're also, and again, we're also going to talk about Linux, which is one of the primary operating systems that we find in the consumer IoT, and the fact that there's really not a lot of add-on protection available for the Linux environment, leaving people vulnerable. So in application security, we talk about something called the application attack surface. And the application attack surface is every avenue, every route, every vector into the application from the outside world that an attacker can leverage and exploit. The attack surface is made up of ports, web services. It can be partly exposed by attacking software and executing buffer overflow attacks and other things that make the application crash. Everything that can be leveraged by the attacker makes up the attack surface. The bigger your attack surface, the more trouble you're in. It should be the goal of all developers who are writing applications that need to be secure to take advantage of locking down the attack surface and making it as small as possible. The consumer electronics space is a very large attack surface. It's really the most vulnerable environment out there. And it's basically because the consumer is not trained in being secure. It's more important for them to watch the television than it is to protect their information. So they don't pay a lot of attention to implementing strong passwords or anything like that. So it really is up to us to take care of them. Consumers are also vulnerable to social engineering attacks, people calling in and saying that they're from their cable company or something like that and getting passwords and connect information out of the consumer. So they really are pretty vulnerable. Our responsibility in this space as vendors is to keep the customer safe. We don't really want to use the term secure because it doesn't mean a lot to the consumer. The consumer is hammered with the safety message from all angles, from automotive to furniture to home security. All these different things are really presented as safety issues. So we need to do whatever we can to fit into that mold and to keep the consumers safe. We need to make sure that their applications are not vulnerable. We need to make sure that the devices that we give them are pre-configured for security and that there's least access privileges assigned to them rather than having them completely open and available to attack out of the box. So security in this space, what's there? There really isn't a whole lot. Most devices are password protected, but there's no enforcement for strong passwords or anything like that. So it's really up to the consumer to take care of themselves. What really should be there is software that's secure by design. It should be the applications that we give to our consumers should be safe out of the box. For applications or for systems that have older software, or vulnerable software that's actually new, we should be providing whitelisting systems, which is de facto standard for level zero protection in the software space these days. And we should be providing accessible education, ways that the consumer can learn about keeping themselves safe and secure, presented in a way that they can easily consume. We have to remember that the people who are using these devices are not IT engineers. They're not they don't have a lot of knowledge in the areas where we're concerned, so we have to make sure that they can understand what we're telling them. So there's basically three different ways that we talk about protecting applications, and in this case, the consumer. First is to write secure code. Now, if you're writing, if you're making brand new software, writing secure code is just a matter of training the engineering staff and making sure that they build secure code out of the box and using things like secure static analysis tools to make sure that, that the code that's being, being checked in is actually up to spec. Another, the second way of protecting is to protect in play. This is for running software for applications that are not new, that have existed and are being reused. We can protect the systems by whitelisting the devices and making sure that no unauthorized applications are running. And we can also use the system to minimize the attack surface. The last is to educate the user. We can provide them with little videos or best practices that describe best practices on the, you know, for using their devices. Things like improving the security awareness and making sure that they understand that they are exposed and giving them options for locking things down. So secure design is one of the core things that we need to do in secure software development. We talk about security in the space by describing usage of applications with use cases, and we also add in abuse cases, which tells the software developer how the system that's being designed can be attacked. So, for example, if a user presses a button to change a CD track, an attacker can actually go in and overflow the IR channel that's being used with a fuzzer and cause the application that's controlling to crash. There are several, you know, tons of examples of these things, and by providing even abuse cases along with use cases, it arms the developer with what he or she needs to code defensively. So, speaking of coding defensively, basically, there are several rules that you have to live by. One is, the first is that you always expect to be attacked. No matter what you do, if you put an application out there, somebody's going to try to break it. And there are several very simple things that you can do to protect yourself by when you're writing new software or when you're going back and maintaining systems. First, use the heap, not the stack, for data. One of the favorite attacks out there is a buffer overflow attack, where somebody attacks a buffer that's living on the stack, and then writing over the edge of it and being able to write code into the end of the overflowed data. Always check your return values. You know, if you go to allocate memory, make sure that you got the memory before you try to use it. Use safe string functions. Typically, these safe string functions define the length of the buffer that you're writing into or you're copying from and to. That allows you to avoid buffer overflows in general. Enable parameter checks with all functions. So always check to see if the values that are coming down to you are valid. They're not null. And if they are, bail out at that point or return a bad value. Enable compiler security checks and canaries. There's lots and lots of very interesting stuff that's built into today's compilers. Canaries are good ones. They tell you where the end of the of your operational segments are. So if anything's written past it, it gives you a warning. And never assume anything. Always make sure that what you're doing is clear, concise, and you've looked at all the angles. Never back down and always expect to be attacked. Okay, so whitelisting is an interesting space for security. What happens with whitelisting or application control is that you have a list of programs that are actually allowed to execute and everything else is denied. So anything that tries to start that isn't in the control list is actually terminated, which makes it very strong and safe, particularly from a security standpoint. If a typical attacker scenario is to get into a system and load their tools onto it, and then execute the tools to attack other systems or the system that they're on. A whitelisted system makes it impossible for a developer's tool or for an attacker's tools to run. Therefore, the attacker is pretty much put down at that point. Whitelisting, as I mentioned earlier, is pretty much the de facto standard for level zero and protection, and it's the only thing that will really protect against zero-day attacks, and zero-day attacks being things that have never been seen before that all of a sudden attackers are using. So approachable education is something that we need to really focus on. This is an area that is pretty critical to reaching the consumer in general. As I mentioned earlier, the consumers are not generally IT savvy. We need to speak to them in a language that they understand and that they can use and glean value from. Things like small videos, graphical prompts, other things along with those of that nature that are simple to absorb and simple to understand are very useful in educating the consumer. Okay. Linux in the Internet of Things. As I mentioned, Linux is roughly 52% of the embedded market overall. Then there's really not a lot of security stuff embedded in it. There are a few things built into Linux, but there aren't a lot of third-party tools. In particular, there's no whitelisting to speak of. It's unclear why there's not a lot of whitelisting stuff out there. It's probably because Linux is changing so rapidly. It's updated every couple of weeks. New kernels, new applications, new system level programs, and things like that. So it's kind of hard to keep on top of it. Windows, on the other hand, is a relatively static environment. I mean, they only update it every couple of years, and the patches are pretty easy to keep up with. Linux is a moving target. With that said, security innovation is actually working in the whitelisting market for Linux security. We have some stuff going on in the whitelisting space that's relatively interesting. It certainly does a lot to make Linux more secure and is directly applicable to the consumer market and the embedded market overall. It is very strong. It's kernel-based and traps anything that tries to execute directly in the kernel. It intercepts everything that's either called by fork or exec-ce, and will stop anything that tries to execute that isn't authorized. It uses HMACs as signatures for the system, so it's locked to the system, and there can be no propagation from one system to another. And it is very clean. It can be used on basically any Linux system and will provide the kind of protection that typical whitelisting systems do in the Windows environment. Okay, wrapping up, the consumer IoT space needs to be locked down. It really is an open space for attackers. There's tons and tons of different vectors that attackers can take. They can break into the systems themselves if they're edge-connected and the security is poor. They can also come in through social engineering. Mechanisms, we can secure applications by design, we can protect them in play, and we can provide education to the consumer. And we see that Linux dominates the embedded space in the consumer and consumer space, and there are very few licensing products, but we do have some research in progress. And all these techniques are portable across the embedded space. You can, regardless of the operating system, you can make them work. And thank you very much. Back to you, Kurt.
Very good. Our next speaker is Greg Fike. He is the director of the Internet of Things Ecosystem Development at Silicon Labs. He previously was the director of marketing for Silicon Labs wireless connectivity products, including sub-gigahertz radios and wireless MCUs. Prior to that, he had marketing and networking product roles at PMC Sierra. He holds a Bachelor's of Applied Science in Computer Engineering from the University of Waterloo. Greg.
Thanks, Kurt. Hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here today to talk about IoT. First, a very quick background on Silicon Labs. We're a broad-based supplier of semiconductor products, such as microcontrollers, solid-state sensors, and wireless ICs. We're very focused on the emerging IoT market, and in this presentation, I'm going to walk you through a view of IoT with a focus on devices and embedded software. I'll also go deeper into details on Zigbee, which is a wireless mesh networking technology designed for IoT products that was built with security in mind. So what exactly do we mean when we say IoT? At a very high level, we tend to think of IoT as simply the next evolution of the Internet. It's a movement that started with desktop computing, has evolved to mobile computing, and is now expanding to just about everything else that could be connected. While there are many differences in the estimates from analysts, there is general agreement that this opportunity is very, very big. Today, there are already more connected devices on the planet than there are people, and IoT is positioned to be the first 10 billion unit a year market. PCs were the first with a 100 million unit per year market, and handsets was the first 1 billion unit market. By 2020, industry leaders predict that the number of internet-connected devices will top 50 billion. Most of these devices will not be traditional PCs, servers, or even smartphones, but smaller, cheaper, simpler embedded devices. IoT, what makes it unique is that it's truly diverse. It's going to change not only the way that people interact with the internet, but also the way they live their lives. It will impact our quality of life, productivity. It's going to bring greater comfort, convenience, security, resource savings, health, and fitness benefits. The explosion in the number of connected and intelligent everyday devices for both business purposes and consumer use will create tremendous opportunities. In short, IoT is a game changer. Let's take a look at the technologies that are required for IoT devices, again, from an embedded perspective. First, here we have processing and connectivity. This is key. One unique element of IoT is that low power is often a very strong factor, and so energy-friendly microcontrollers is key. Robust and interoperable wireless networks. And again, this is not really a one-size-fits-all situation. There are solutions such as Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, and Zigbee, which I'll be going into more detail later, that all provide unique benefits, strengths, and weaknesses for the IoT market. And there are multiple standards out there depending on what specific use cases are required. Security is also a key element. A lot of talk and discussion has been about securing the IoT space, and many of the speakers just before me had much to say about this. Within the embedded space, what's key, again, is cryptographic hardware acceleration and having efficient, low-power, small form factor algorithms. When you think about an IoT end node, some of the key elements here are the ability to sense, the ability to process, control, actuate, and communicate. And one of the key factors here, again, is actually having sensor components and actuators that allow applications to sense light, environmental conditions, motions, and power. And one of the key elements tying this all together and making this realizable today is a CMOS. So mixed signal CMOS integration being key, tying all of these factors into single IC architectures. Benefits of CMOS are that it provides ultra-low energy consumption. It's a very cost-effective solution and is capable of supporting a very broad range of applications. So why is IoT happening now? Let's take a look at some of the major computing paradigms and see how much things have actually changed. So first, we have desktop computing. This is the advent of the Internet, large, bulky, but very powerful systems with Intel-class processors, the ability to expand peripherals, storage, and memory. Not very portable and always plugged in. Laptops were the beginning of connected mobility, but it wasn't until the advent of the smartphone did we truly realize an untethered Internet. Still, these platforms still have a lot of horsepower, and in some cases approach the power of a desktop computer in your hand. Many still utilize Intel-class processors and have a lot of storage. To a large extent, ARM has led the way in handsets, but these devices still operate at hundreds of megahertz in terms of clock frequencies and often do not last more than a day on a battery. I can certainly attest to that with my own iPhone. IoT is different. You can see that already from this graph here. These are small, relatively simple devices that serve a very broad range of markets, but they're also very resource constrained. This is the world of microcontrollers, not microprocessors. Here we're talking about clock frequencies of tens of megahertz, not hundreds of megahertz, kilobytes of memory, not megabytes. What's amazing is that these devices still provide mobility. They can actually be implemented in a single chip and have the potential to last on a battery for many years. Security is key to the internet, and a lot of speakers have talked about that before me here as well, and that remains true for IoT. A lot of time, effort, and attention has been applied to securing the internet, which is, again, far beyond the scope of our call today. But as we all know, security is only as good as the weakest link. And so let's step through some of these and take a look. So you can see that security here is provided really at every single link in the chain. And despite many of the concerns raised about IoT and the fact that these devices happen to be very resource constrained, I wanted to highlight that there are already wireless IoT solutions in the market today, such as Zigbee, that have been designed with security in mind. So digging a bit deeper here, I wanted to give you some more insight into how Zigbee addresses three core concepts with respect to security. On the left, you can see confidentiality, integrity, and authenticity. On the right, you can see a packet structure for a Zigbee frame. Confidentiality is realized by encrypting the payload. Zigbee happens to use AES-128 encryption to secure this payload with specific keys. Integrity is realized with a message integrity check field that you can see appended to the very end of the Zigbee frame, and it's calculated across the network header, auxiliary header, and the payload itself. This ensures that the data is not modified during transit while over the air. Authenticity is realized by the combination of the fact that there is a source and destination address and a field that is part of the auxiliary header that is a frame counter. And this frame counter is incremented every frame that is sent from the device. A key feature that ties all these things together within Zigbee is the concept of hop-by-hop security. Again, Zigbee is a mesh networking solution. So at every hop, messages are decrypted at that node. They're then re-encrypted at that node with the key before sending off to the next node. And this process allows these nodes to block attempts to inject bad traffic into the network. So to tie this all together, let me walk you through a simplified example and show you how security is established in a Zigbee network. So here we have a Zigbee gateway on the left, a very simple light switch, and a humidity sensor. When these devices are first shipped, one of the key concepts here is the idea of a pre-shared key that is used for this AES encryption. The Zigbee gateway is, in this case here, going to be our trust center. And the other devices in this network are going to be requesting to join to that network. In that process, the Zigbee gateway or trust center then sends yet another unique key that is generated by that trust center, and it is securely sent over using the pre-shared key to the end devices and routed through, as you can see, the light switch to the humidity sensor. After that network key has been exchanged by the devices, they're then capable of transmitting traffic securely between these devices using the principles that I've just described. So wrapping up here, Silicon Labs, again, is a semiconductor company with a very strong focus on the IoT market that has a very broad and complete portfolio of semiconductor products for IoT. MCUs, we have a very broad line of 8-bit 8051 microcontrollers and 32-bit ARM Cortex-M class microprocessors. These are very, very low energy and a lot of capabilities built into very small form factors. Wireless solutions, we have Zigbee solutions, wireless MCUs and sub-gigahertz transceivers. And then we have a number of solid-state sensors such as ambient and UV light sensors, IR proximity, and gesture detection. Tying this all together is a Simplicity Studios, which is a tool that is free to download from our website. And Simplicity Studios provides a very flexible, integrated development environment, demos, code examples, and everything you need to prototype and bring your product to production. We also provide tools that allow you to quickly realize Zigbee certifiable solutions and tools that allow you to monitor and inspect traffic within a Zigbee network. Back to you, Kurt.
Thank you very much. We are now to the Q&A portion. We'll try to get right to it and answer as many as we can. We've got lots of good questions coming in. So let's start with Sanjay. Since these devices are made by so many different manufacturers, how can you ensure interoperability, or are there IoT interoperability standards out there being developed?
Yeah, that's a great question, Kurt. You know, the industry has grappled with trying to come with one standard for several decades in the industrial world, and with good intent, but it's hard to find, you know, manufacturers from so many different continents working on one protocol. It's hard to get convergence on one protocol. But what has happened, and we've been doing this for a couple of decades now, is that people do come together to define profiles for devices that they can agree upon. So profiles can be really simple. IOs, what IOs does the device respond to and provide? You know, how do you measure these IOs? For example, if it's measuring temperature, what is the granularity that you measure it in? What is the range of the temperature values? And if we can agree on these profiles, and different manufacturers can then certify their agreement to these profiles, that is sufficient to get these devices to interoperate. And that's worked very well in the industry. In the absence of a common protocol standard, having device profiles, standardized device profiles, has worked really well.
Okay, very good. David, there are some security questions coming in, as you would expect. You mentioned about central security management, or not being more distributed as opposed to centralized. How does DDS set up security for all the devices and user access within the network?
Sure. So I should clarify that a centralized server or broker is not used at runtime once applications discover and authenticate each other. So typically the security policies in your system, you know, are set up initially by a centralized authority and, you know, on discovery time. So when two applications, you know, first try to establish communication, it could be using a centralized certificate authority to do that authentication. But once two applications are authenticated, as well as the configuration information that says what access control each application has, then data is flowing peer-to-peer between the different applications or participants. There's no longer a central broker or server at that point. So at runtime, when real-time performance and complete reliability are a requirement, there is no central broker at that point.
Okay, I see. So, Pete, there's a couple questions I'm going to lump together here. One has to do with, can you just run static analysis to check to see if your code is secure? And then there's just kind of an open-ended question about security issues in general, in terms of, you talked from the developer's perspective, are there things people can do with their IoT devices to ensure security of, you know, applications being downloaded on an IoT device?
Well, as far as static analysis goes, static analysis is a great tool for uncovering defects in your code. But nothing really is as good as the good old Mark I eyeball. People looking at your code and making sure that it's built securely is really the best thing to be looking at. The static analysis is good for low-hanging fruit. As far as what a consumer can do to protect themselves today, you look at some of the boxes that we're talking about, set-top video streamers and things like that. Really, the only thing you can do from a consumer standpoint is to set up strong passwords, pretty long ones with random characters and so on, and pay attention to who you're talking to on the telephone. As I mentioned earlier, the social engineering attack is a really strong one in the consumer space. I mean, things like phishing, things like people calling, claiming to represent your cable company or your satellite company, looking for passwords to your system. You just have to be very aware of that kind of thing.
Okay. Very good. There's a lot of questions coming in on Zigbee for Greg. Let's start with Zigbee and battery life. How much battery life should you be able to expect from a Zigbee-based product?
That's a great question, Kurt. That's actually one of the unique capabilities of Zigbee is it does support a class of device that is an end device that is actually capable of sleeping for long periods of time. And depending how you configure that solution and application, we have examples where a Zigbee device that has a very low duty cycle, around 1%, can last for potentially 10 years plus on very small batteries. Conversely to that, I mean, devices that may be very active, we typically expect to see something closer to 3 to 5 years.
Okay. Very good. David, in terms of Kinect DDS, there's a question about how to get data from Kinect's DDS into the cloud. Do you have any kind of information there?
Sure. There's a couple different ways. So Kinect's DDS itself can run over a lot of different transports, both IP and non-IP networks. So at some level, applications are really location independent. So whether you're running, you know, in the cloud or, you know, in a machine or device at the edge, it's really transparent and you can communicate, you know, in a case like that over an internet connection using TCP, for example, between that device and the cloud, which could be going over, you know, any type of ISP or even a cellular connection. The other scenario that we often see is that, you know, within a machine I might be using some very high-performance network and protocol. Maybe I'm running over shared memory or Blackplane or UDP. So for a case like that, we provide something we call our routing service, which basically takes data that's being distributed in that machine and then can forward it over your wide area network to your data center or cloud-based systems. And you can also configure that to, you know, only send a limited amount of data because, of course, often, you know, when you're dealing at the edge, you're dealing in millions of messages a second, and depending on your network type connecting to the cloud, you probably don't want to forward all of that data. So you can then just selectively forward a subset of data, like the last value of a sensor every second or minute, for example, you know, based on what the capacity of your network is and the amount of data that you're actually, you know, need to store or process in the cloud.
Okay, and there was a related question about big data integrations and modelings. If you have any examples of those, was it fairly straightforward? And did you find value in the level of data you were acquiring?
Yes, I mean, that's definitely one of the very common use cases amongst our customers using the technique I just described for getting data, you know, typically into the cloud or data center where your big data analysis is happening. And we also provide a couple other capabilities that you can actually run in the data center or cloud to facilitate that is, you know, one is we have what we call our database integration service you can just use to take streaming data and automatically stream that right into a database. We also have a recording service you can use to just take that data and log it into a file so you can get, you know, very high performance recording of real-time data that then you can use for your big data analytics.
Okay, very good. We are planning to stay over just a few minutes so we can get to more questions. So the audience, if you're interested, you can certainly stay with us, and we'll try to answer as many as we can in the extra time. Pete, the presentation on security and IoT, you focused on some consumer devices. What about security and industrial commercial IoT where perhaps you can constrain the environment a little bit, maybe do some policing of downloaded applications, so that you can kind of externally identify and prevent viruses and things like that?
Well, yeah. The applications that run in the industrial space are have the same flaws and vulnerabilities as those in the consumer space. The ICS space has some advantages over the commercial space, and that is that they have professional IT folks. There are several things that you can do from an application security standpoint to lock things down. Again, whitelisting is the first thing that comes to mind, making sure that nothing that's downloaded or otherwise put on the system can run if it's not authorized. The other things that people that can be done are locking down the external access points, the attack vectors that are most often floated through by attackers, things like open ports, web services that are published publicly that anybody can consume, things of that nature.
Okay. Very good. Greg, more Zigbee questions. The first one is, how does Zigbee ensure interoperability between end products?
Sure. One of the unique features of Zigbee is that it actually defines the application layer, meaning that basically defines the language that products need to communicate, which is very unlike something like Wi-Fi, which is very much a transport layer-based protocol. And by that, Zigbee Alliance is actually made up of a number of end device manufacturers, and things like door locks and heat pumps and various other devices have all now created specific profiles for these devices so that they can, all vendors that are supplying Zigbee equipment can use that common language to communicate to these devices. But the most exciting piece about that is how those messages are interpreted and then ultimately acted upon is up to each device manufacturer so that you can still innovate within that framework.
Okay, and then there was a question about Zigbee and possible difficulties configuring and managing for consumers and developers alike. Can you comment on how Zigbee addresses those concerns or any issues there? Or?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Zigbee has really come a long way. I think from the early days that may have been true, but we're now at a point in time in the Zigbee space where the tools, and in particular some of the tools that Silicon Labs offers, actually will allow you to create Zigbee certifiable solutions in a very, very short period of time. So that framework that I just mentioned is all built within the tools so that you can create these devices, and then we leave the stubs within the code to then implement how you actually want to, again, interpret those devices. So biggest change here, I'd say, is really the advancement in tools that's available for Zigbee solutions that's now made it much easier for developers to get Zigbee solutions working into production that are also certifiable.
Okay. Sanjay, if someone's new to control networking, does it matter which protocol they choose or what kinds of things they should they be concerned about when they're selecting the right control networking technology for an IoT application?
Well, yeah, if you're new to control networking, that's very good news because then you're no longer bogged down by this 30-year legacy of being backward compatible. But at the same time, you want to pick a very feature-rich control protocol and mechanism, something that is proven, reliable, scalable, of course. But very importantly, it needs to have a rich set of control services, as I indicated in one of my slides in my presentation, that relies on a publish-subscribe model, has elaborate device binding mechanisms, supports reliable message delivery, standard device profiles, and can more or less self-install, so it simplifies the installation procedure. And these services should be abstracted away from the actual media that it's being carried on, whether it's wired or wireless, and wired could be Ethernet or free topology or RF communication. I'm sorry, power line communications, and the wireless could be Wi-Fi or RF. You want to have a common control networking scheme over all of this, and very importantly, it should be IP enabled so that you can liberate the data that's being acted upon here. I think if you pay attention to these selection criteria, you'll find that there's very few available options that really meet these standards.
Hmm. Okay. Interesting. That kind of leads to another question. I'll start with David on this question, but I think we'll just kind of go around the horn. It's an excellent question. It's that kind of two parts where the person asks about what about more efficient protocols like MQTT or only sending on change? Are we getting closer to a standard that minimizes data usage costs for cellular and or satellite? We have to worry about the network infrastructure, of course, and overloading it, or protocols similar to OPC UA and things like that. The second part of the question is, are tiers emerging, like sensor gateway object in the reference diagram, a gateway to the cloud, et cetera? If so, what protocol do you see settling in with these tiers? David, let's have you start to tackle that question.
Sure. So, DDS, which is the protocol that RTI supports in our Connects DDS product, is an alternative protocol to MQTT that, for many applications is actually far more efficient than MQTT. So MQTT typically runs over TCP and uses that centralized approach. So everything talks through a broker you know, which is the common architecture and IT systems, or the consumer Internet of Things, before intelligent systems and intelligent machines where you want peer-to-peer communication, DDS is a lot more efficient because it doesn't have that intermediate broker as part of exchanges. It's also not tied to having TCP or a reliable protocol underneath. So MQTT, again, generally expects that the network is reliable, but often, you know, what you find in Internet of Things types environments is the network might not be reliable, especially when you're dealing with low bandwidth networks like a satellite or radio link. So DDS has, as part of the protocol, its own reliability layer, so it can run over poor quality networks without impacting the applications. So applications still get the benefit of reliability, or at least visibility into how the network is doing, without having to require a heavyweight protocol over the wire itself.
Right. Okay. Pete, how do you see these tiers emerging? Do you see kind of reference diagrams where you have IoT sensors and gateways and gateways and clouds? And what are the security implications when you're talking about that kind of a model?
Well, yeah, we are seeing tiers coming out. I mean, it's to be expected, all the different levels of participation in the network. As far as testing these things go for security, one of our favorite techniques is something called fuzzing. And what fuzzing is corrupting the data that the packets are the protocols carrying around with it, the information that's actually in there. And by fuzzing that the data that's coming or getting into the application, we can actually create some spectacular crashes, typically because the content of the protocol packet is not tested before it's consumed. So using this technique, we can figure out a lot about what the security profile of the application is.
I see. Okay, great, Greg. In terms of these other protocols and things, how do you see that playing out in the world of IoT?
Sure, I'll try and address that at least from the perspective of wireless protocols. And I'd say what we're seeing there is really deployment of protocols that meet specific needs. And maybe a case in point here is Wi-Fi is a fantastic solution if you're trying to transport large amounts of data in relatively short spaces or short ranges, you have only a few devices in that network, whereas something like Bluetooth, for example, is fantastic if you're trying to have an IoT device that's communicating with a handset of some form, but again, it's very limited point-to-point connectivity. Where Zigbee comes into play is, again, the fact that it's a mesh network, it allows for scalability to large amounts of nodes that require a very little amount of battery, so it can operate from things as something as coin cells that can be very scalable, low data rate and very scalable up to, in some cases, tens of thousands of nodes. So I'd say that maybe not necessarily a standard, but certainly standards are being addressed depending on what the needs are of the end application.
Okay, great. And Sanjay, closing out on this, do you have any comments on the protocols and the tiers of IoT as they're emerging?
From an industrial perspective, I think we pay a lot of attention to converging protocols that have been in existence and migrating them to an IP world. And, what we found is what you really need is an environment that's open, a development environment that's very open, where you can provide TCP or UDP-based sockets. And it's possible with a incremental amount of development effort to help all of these legacy protocols to be converged onto, fewer platforms. And we're attacking this problem, one step at a time at Echelon ourselves.
Right. Okay, very good. That brings us to the conclusion of today's eCast. Thank you very much, Sanjay, David, Pete, and Greg, for sharing your expertise and insights on connecting the Internet of Things. We at Open Systems Media, Echelon, RTI, Security Innovation, and Silicon Labs also want to thank all of you, the audience, for attending today and contributing excellent questions remotely. This eCast will be posted online at the URL shown on your screen. and an audio-only podcast version will also be made available there. You can do a web search with the keywords embedded space e-cast and find all of Open Systems Media eCast available for download as MP3s. Thank you for attending, and have a great day.